Case number 96 from the Book of Serenity. Introduction. Yunju didn't rely on relics, the jewels of discipline. Jiufeng didn't admire sitting or standing death. Niu To didn't need the birds to bring flowers. Wangbo didn't envy sailing on a wine cup across a river. But tell me, what is their strong point? The case. Jiufeng worked as an attendant of Shishuang. When Shishuang passed away, the community wanted to invite the first-ranked monk in the hall to succeed to the abbacy. Jiufeng did not agree. He said, "Wait until I have questioned him. If he understands our late teacher's meaning, I'll serve him like our late teacher." Then he asked the chief monk. The late teacher said, "Cease, desist, spend 10,000 years in one thought. Be cold ashes, dead trees, be a censer in an ancient shrine, be a strip of pure white silk." Now, tell me, which side does this illustrate? And the chief monk said, "It illustrates the matter of absolute oneness." Jiufeng said, "Then you still don't understand the late teacher's meaning." The chief monk said, "You don't agree with me? Set up some incense." The chief monk then lit the incense and said, "If I don't understand the late teacher's meaning, then I won't be able to pass away while this incense is still burning." So saying, he sat down and died. Jiufeng then caressed his shoulder and said, "As far as dying, seated, or standing is concerned, you're not lacking. But as for our late teacher's meaning, you still haven't even dreamed of seeing it." In Hongzhi's verse, the school of Shishuang was personally transmitted to Jiufeng. Passing away in incense smoke, the true bloodline cannot go through. The crane nesting on the moon has a 1,000-year dream. The man in the snowy room is deluded by the achievement of oneness. Cutting off the 10 directions still gets a failing mark. Quietly move a step, and behold, a flying dragon. So, the fourth day on this koan, maybe you're getting tired of it. Maybe you're beginning to hear things in it that you were unable to hear before. 4 days with a koan is really nothing. The first koan I ever worked on took me 9 years to understand, but I guess I'm just slow. The time frame is spacious in koan practice. The time frame is the same as in shikantaza practice and breath practice, because in Zen practice, there is nothing to achieve. Although there is the appearance of achievement, and this can be confusing, because after all, there are today 3 people, and tonight there'll be 4 people when Josh comes back from working in Boston, with different color raksus and some of us with robes draped around us, some of us with shaven heads. It kind of looks like a mark of difference. It kind of looks like a mark of elevation. And it's important to know that in spite of the experience of most Soto Zen priests in Boundless Way Zen, as our dear friend Dosho Port has remarked a number of times, in Boundless Way Zen, our priests feel the robes of the priesthood as a great burden. They're really uncomfortable. They're hot. You might not see it from the beautiful appearance, but it really takes a long time to figure out how to wear them. For many of us, years and years. I don't think I'm set yet. I'm always a little ashamed when I dress up with other Soto monks and priests. But it's good for us, maybe. Who knows? I don't know. We do it anyway. We had a little discussion the other day. Maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should just wear roksus, ditch these uncomfortable robes, the robes of our ancestors. And we laughed and put them on the next day. No matter what we're feeling, somehow or other, we've taken on this, and now I'm going to put the word in air quotes, burden. Because there's something inside of us that decided that we wanted to take on this practice in a different way. Everyone who becomes a priest in Boundless Way has their own reason for doing it. In my case, I did it because my teacher, James Ford, said, I want you to do it. And I had the habit of being a jisha, an attendant. And I said, okay, and bowed. And I really didn't want to do it. But I did it. And I don't think I complained too much on the route to getting all my robes and the sewing that so many people did for me. Some of you in this room right now, the great gift of finding help. I was recalling the other day that two of our old friends in the Dharma sewed the little shirt that I wear underneath all these endless layers in this heat. This shirt they embroidered with the word breathe on the inside. Every time I put it on, I remember that I am not doing what I do by myself. This is a really important teaching for me personally, and I hope you can hear a little bit of it for yourself. But even though we do not talk to each other, or at least we try to avoid talking, we don't make eye contact unless it's absolutely necessary, we sit on our little tiny zabatons all by ourselves in the big crowded room, we're not alone. We are supported not only by the people in the room, but all the people who are in our great Sangha, our Maha Sangha, which not only includes people in Boundless Way Zen who practice this great way, but also includes everyone who makes it possible for us to practice. And if we extrapolate that particular one outward, it includes everyone and everything in all directions. We are completely supported by the universe. But we don't always feel that. And that is one of the great teachings of Sashin. Sometimes we sit on our cushions and feel so alone. Nobody understands my suffering. Nobody understands what I'm going through. Nobody understands my great screw-ups and my despair, my fears. And then it can flip in a moment and we can get into the, nobody understands how great the Dharma is, how wonderful. Look at that flower. Nobody gets it but me. This is very common. And one of the things that sometimes happens when we share these things in Doksan, which used to be the only way they could be shared, and now in the Dharma dialogues, just by speaking our experience, the Sangha or the teacher or the whole world receives your experience. And sometimes the analogy is used that it's like suffering or difficulties or even an expanded ego of joy and happiness is sometimes described as being like a cup of salt. When it's kept in the little cup in our own hearts, it's very, very salty. It doesn't really serve us so much. But when we dump the salt into a bowl of water, the water's still salty, but it's a little bit more useful. And when we drop it in the hugest container of all, maybe a great lake, then the water is drinkable, even though there's salt in it. And this is what happens, this endless expansion of our experience until we stop using the words with their limiting and painful quality, I, me, and mine. My suffering, my enlightenment. I'm a priest. Look at me. I'm a Zen teacher. So cool, huh? I'm a Zen practitioner. Other people outside Sesshin don't know how wonderful this is or how terrible this is. It doesn't make any difference whether they know it or not. Because that just that saying that I'm all alone in the little bubble of myself is one of the many and perhaps the most persistent root causes of suffering. When Shakyamuni Buddha was born, according to our Zen legend, this doesn't really appear in Theravada texts as far as I know, he took 7 steps. He was a very intelligent little baby. And he pointed up towards the sky and he pointed down towards the earth and he said, in heaven above and earth below, I am the only one. And he didn't mean, look at me, I just took 7 steps, I'm such a great baby. He meant, I am the sky and the ground. I am the stars and the moon. I am everything that I encounter. There is nothing that is not part of this person here. In this koan, we see someone falling into the trap of what Yasutani Roshi used to call pernicious oneness, a oneness that is poisonous, a oneness that causes people to close themselves up. The kind of oneness that the little baby Buddha was pointing to is very different. It's the kind of oneness that makes us open up, feel all the possibilities of this great blooming world that is endlessly offering itself to us. And we refuse this world in favor of our self-incriminating thoughts. And you know you have them. I'm a terrible meditator. I'm a great meditator. I don't know what's going on. I'm so lost. And that's bad. I don't know what's going on, and I'm so lost, and that's good. The self is endlessly creative. The self is all about judging right and wrong and good and bad. The self loves to do this. It's the only thing it knows. And in our practice here, we say that everything that occurs is part and parcel of this great way, and nothing is excluded. That means that your thoughts are not excluded. Your judgmental thoughts are not excluded. Your feelings of being alone are not excluded. Everything is it. We sort of buy into this intellectually at some point. Some of us resist it for a really long time, sometimes decades. But even if we buy into it intellectually, until we know this for sure, until we find what we call the heart of true and trusting, it's just an idea and it can be batted down by life, by the sorrows and joys that endlessly arise and pass away. This poem of Hongzhi, one of our wonderful ancestors, we have a few of his pieces in our liturgy book, and he wrote all the poems, all the verses in the Book of Serenity. This is pointing to something that is embedded in the koan, but isn't explicit in the actual koan story. And we spoke about it a little bit yesterday. It's about the transmission of the Dharma. What Hongzhi says is the school of Shishuang, and this is the teacher of Jufeng and the teacher of the head monk, was personally transmitted to Jufeng. The school of Shishuang was personally transmitted to Zhufeng. Passing away in incense smoke, the true bloodline cannot get through. What is this true bloodline? What is this passing along of the transmission? Well, it's happening right now in this room. Whenever any one of us speaks what we feel is the truth of our hearts, what we have discovered in the Dharma, what we struggle with, what we don't understand, there's a transmission of the Dharma. The Dharma is like a roaring stream. It has such a strong force. It pulls us and pushes us as if we're rocks in that roaring stream. And it somehow or other, even though it's not personal and it's not some consciousness, no guy in the sky with a beard, it still has this intense energy to it that finds its expression in our zazen. It finds expression in lots of other places too. It finds expression in the Catholic Mass. It finds expression in Jewish synagogues and mosques and churches of all kinds and temples everywhere, Hindu and Jain and everything. Everything. And the Atheist Association and philosophers and scientists. Everything is motivated by this great energy to solve the great problems of the heart. Everyone wants this. For those of us in this room, and I'm making a little assumption here because maybe it's not true for all of us, but for many of us in this room, we found that Zen is the form that it takes to solve the problems of our hearts. And so when we get together like this, the Dharma is transmitted to us. And it's transmitted sometimes with a lot of roadblocks and difficulties. It gets in, but then we kind of bat it away like we're batting away mosquitoes. We don't want to know this stuff. We'd rather cling to our favorite self-incriminations because at least they're familiar. And this Dharma, this is confusing. This is not a teaching that speaks to the rational mind. It does up to a point and then really falls off the cliff. If you've already discovered that, you know what I mean. If you're still saying, no, this makes sense, you don't know that yet. And when it falls off the cliff, we fall with it. And things happen that we could never have imagined would ever happen to us. So James said, I want you to be a priest. And I grudgingly did all the things you do to be a priest. And then in the ceremony itself, and you'll see tomorrow night, those of you who are staying through Wednesday night, Paul Galvin is going to ordain as a priest. That's why he has that funny haircut. Part of the ceremony is that I get to cut his hair, but we've streamlined it for the 21st century, so he does most of the cutting and just leaves this little top knot up at the top, and I snip it off. When I was standing in front of James, the new priest is only wearing the funny haircut and a white robe, the little white shirt under robe that mine says breathe, and the outer robe, a white kimono, and stands. And something transformed inside me, and I can't tell you what it was. I actually don't have any words for it. One of you was saying the other day that you just can't find words for it. That's really not a problem. If I say anything about what happened to me in that moment, it would be disparaging of it. It would be minimizing it, really boxing it up. But all I can tell you is that something happened, and I stopped fighting my teacher's request. And I just started to cry, and I didn't stop through the whole ceremony. And that turns out that that's sort of a thing for me. I tend to cry a lot. Actually, it's been a thing for a long time, even before the ordination, as David could tell you. What were those tears? It wasn't sorrow. It wasn't shame. It wasn't any of the ordinary things that provoke tears. It was some kind of standing in the middle of the biggest body of water, this little pillar of salt. That was me. And then, I can't tell you what's happened since, but I didn't set out to be a Zen teacher. I didn't set out to be a Zen priest, but I did set out to want to know what the fuck is going on. That was my motivation from early childhood. I did not take seven steps when I was born. But as soon as I started to be able to use my rational mind, I thought, what? No. And then, of course, things happened. People died. People I really cared about. My Nana died first. I had a dog that was hit and killed in front of me by a truck. These things were really inexplicable. And then my father died. What is going on here? What is the truth of life and death? I wanted to know it so badly. I tried everything. I'm not going to tell you all the things I tried, but you can imagine what I tried because I grew up in the 60s. There was lots of stuff going on then. There were religious adepts on every corner trying to force incense on you and chanting really strange haircuts and clothes and other stuff. But it wasn't until I heard about Zen that I found my home. And for a long time, I wasn't a Zen practitioner. I just studied it. I took a course in it in college and read books. And, you know, by then it was the 70s. And then I met my first Zen teacher, and I knew he knew something that I wanted to know. Or at least that was my fantasy. It turned out that I knew it the whole time, and I needed to discover it for myself. And bit by bit, throughout these 60 years, I have been discovering it. And I gotta tell you, this discovery never ends. And then another thing happened, which is kind of amazing. My boyfriend and I decided that we wanted to study Zen together. The person that I loved most in all the world shared this deep yearning. That was incredible. So we got married, and he's sitting on my left right now. And all these years, we didn't imagine we'd ever be Zen teachers living in a temple, being the guiding teachers of this amazing organization of sanghas, of great hearts beating together. That was not something we could have ever planned, but it was that force of the Dharma, what sometimes called bodhicitta, driving us on that great roaring stream, and we got hit by a lot of rocks, but we kept going with the stream. What else can you do? At some point, you just surrender. I just surrendered. There wasn't anything else I could do. I mean, I could have kept trying to swim upstream and get hit by rocks, but it wasn't worth it. And then I met my second Zen teacher, James Ford, who is still, although he considers himself my peer now, he's still my teacher. He asked me to ordain, and I did it. He asked me to do lots of things that if I had been really in my right mind, I probably would have refused to do. He encouraged us in the temple. He encouraged David to become a member of our little teacher sangha. First he invited me to teach beside him, and then he invited David too, and then eventually Josh. And it's an amazing thing to teach with other people, because that feeling that so many of us carry of being alone, I had to work really hard to maintain that delusion. My partner in life shares the Dharma with me, and yet still I can fall into feeling alone. I teach with three extraordinary people, and still I can feel alone. I sit today with 40 extraordinary people and countless others, and still I can feel this isolation. It's pretty foolish, but it's persistent. So it's also part of the Dharma, so I bow to it too. But every once in a while, my heart just melts when I realize how many of you, how many of us in this room share that same yearning that I first discovered when I was so young. And when I meet one of you in Doksan, and that little resonating thing starts happening, and if you've felt it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't felt it, stop planning what you're going to say at Doksan. That's one way to feel it. And so this session, we did this interesting thing. We set up a session that has three ceremonies of committing more strongly to this yearning, this great roaring stream of the Dharma. We had four people on Sunday, and one of you is still here, take the precepts of the Zen way. These riddles, these koans of how to live a life in the Dharma. And one of the things about taking Jukai is that you get to decide if you want to do it. Sometimes your teacher might say, I think you should take Jukai, but most of the time it's, I want to do this. Something rises up and you think, I want to do it. And we say, okay, good. The same thing goes, by the way, for ordination. We don't go around and, you know, it's not like a game of duck, duck, goose. Duck, 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 priest. Every once in a while, somebody foolish enough to want to don these robes and this odd responsibility of being a boundless way Zen priest comes forward to one of us and says, I want to be a priest. And we try to put them off. And the ones who are dressed as priests in this room were very stubborn. They said, no, I really do. I really want to. And so there's a process we go through, and process of figuring out. We don't, you know, test them. We don't expect anybody to light incense and die, nothing like that. But there's a period of consideration, and then and one of the many things that we look for is a capacity to devote your life to service. A capacity to really take seriously that there's nothing else to do but this. You know, there's all kinds of other stuff to do. This is an odd kind of person who wants to ordain. Everything suddenly gets swept up into that roaring stream. In Boundless Way Zen, we're very clear. Being a priest is not better than being a lay person. You never have to ordain. But maybe you can appreciate the strangeness of the minds and hearts of those who want to. And maybe be grateful that they're doing it so you don't have to. But you do get to choose. That's up to you. And we bow and we say, okay, after you surmount all the obstacles. And probably the most important piece of our criteria is that you have to have demonstrated that you've fallen on your butt in public. You have to have screwed up so royally that other people notice. That's part of being a priest in Boundless Way Zen. It really makes me kind of proud. It's a good home for me. And then there's this other matter, this thing with Shishuang and Jufeng, all these stories we hear about transmission. Because there also is a transmission where we recognize, and you can't do this, I'm sorry, but you can't say, come up to, well, you can say it, you can come up and say, I want to be a teacher. And we don't, we just go, uh-huh, yeah, thank you, go sit more. Because you can't decide you want to be a teacher. I didn't decide, David didn't decide, Josh didn't decide, James didn't decide, Kate didn't decide. None of us said, yeah, this is what I want, this is my career path, I want to be a Zen teacher. It's a really not a good career path, by the way. Don't get caught in that one. But every once in a while, somebody comes along who continually demonstrates a capacity to share their hearts with others regularly and more and more and more. And when that starts happening, then we start saying, I wonder if you'd like to be a practice leader. I wonder if you'd like to be a Dharma teacher and give talks. I wonder if you'd like to be a senior Dharma teacher and do Doksan. And it's kind of cool. And people show up for those jobs. Almost always, when we name a practice leader, they've already been functioning that way. When we name a Dharma teacher, someone who can give talks and lead the Sangha in that way, they've already been functioning that way. And senior Dharma teachers, and we have quite a few of them here, have really demonstrated some capacity to be present with one other human being in Doksan. And so we recognize it. It's like a recognition rather than a promotion. And then sometimes we realize that somebody has touched our own hearts as teachers so much that they've become teachers for us. And so we begin the process of the transmission of the Dharma. So Kate is one of those people. And the great thing about true teachers is that they don't get that they're true teachers. If you think you're a great teacher, you're very far away from even being a practice leader. It just doesn't work that way. And I've been lucky enough to already have transmitted the Dharma to one of my students, James Cordova. And Thursday night, in a private ceremony that, sadly, because of the customs of this Soto path, you don't get to witness, I'm going to transmit the Dharma to Diane Fitzgerald. I'm so grateful for every single one of you in this room. I'm so grateful for a life that is surrounded by teachers, by sincere practitioners of the way. Please don't make the mistake of thinking that Diane and Paul and Kate and David and me and Josh are somehow different from you. This is a completely together enterprise. Thank you all for your practice. Well, that's not the talk I was going to give. But please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. All of you bodhisattvas out there.
Melissa, as you were talking, my mind went back around to that salt metaphor, and I was, and it came to me. I just had the image of rock salt. You know, it's hard and it's pointy, and you can even cut with it. You know, and you put it in warm water, and then it's like the boar. You know, resistance is futile. It just, you know, it can't retain its hardness, and it can't retain its cuttingness. And so, how do I get in the water?
I hate to break this to you. You're drowning in it.
Somehow I knew you'd say that.
But I'm sure that David or Kate has something a little bit better to say. Do you?
I as you were talking about it, and since you bring it back up, I was thinking about my point of view here. So different from all the other sesshins I've attended. My point of view here is so different from all the other sesshins I've attended. And I have the opportunity to see everybody as they file in, bowing to each other, bowing to each other. And I realize that even though so often we feel as though we're sitting alone on a cushion with our stuff going on, we get up again, and then we acknowledge the support of everyone across from us and next to us, and it's returned. Every time we stand up and bow, acknowledging that we're doing this together, even if we don't feel it as that, nevertheless, here we are doing it, steeped in the ocean, salt dissolving all over the place. You can't help but be part of it. I see you do. We bow to each other.
What did you see?
Todd,
and then Ray.
Did you raise your hand?
No, I was just...
Okay, got to be careful.
I know Melissa. It's very good, so...
to your Todd.
Oh, thank you, Todd. Like what you just said. Somebody had their hand up in the...
Mike.
Oh, Mike, how about Ray and then Mike?
Very moved by what you said. When you said, please don't make the mistake of thinking that that there's people who have been chosen are in some way better, special. Mm-hmm. And I make that mistake all the time.
Yeah.
And it's unavoidable that it comes up. I think, you know, growing up in this culture of acquisition and mm-hmm. and greed being such, and jealousy and envy and those kinds of forces very active and do show up when we pay attention, you know, especially in sesshin. Mm-hmm. And grateful to have a way to be with them.
Thank you.
I'm reminded of the line in the dedication, we say, birds and trees and rocks and we ourselves come forth in perfect harmony. And this perfect harmony is not what we thought it was. And this invitation to show up as ourselves. Of course, it's the last person we think to bring along. We want to bring our Zen self, bring our calm self. Right, but somehow this unbelievable teaching of Sangha is that we are already part of this ocean of Sangha, and it's already dissolving us. Yeah. Thanks. So, Laura, and then Pierce.
Melissa, I so much appreciate your sharing some details about your journey with us, which, you know, as you talk, you know, obviously you're reflecting your own humanness and struggle, and I think we need to be reminded of that. Like Ray, and I think like so many of us, we tend to project things on teachers, which is really runs counter to the Dharma, but, you know, there are all kinds of things that are running counter in this practice. And it made me think about my own path, which I think, I'm sure other people can identify with this, but there have been a lot of rocks in the path. And for me, there's been like this, for many years, such a strong pull towards Zen, and another part of me was like, there are too many rules here. Everything you're supposed to remember, it's so about being wrong a lot. That couldn't be right, you know? So I did Vipassana for quite a while, you know? After having sat here for a while, you know, I went to Barry and did a couple of retreats. And there just was, you know, people sitting around with, you know, blankets from their beds on them and moving all around, you know? And I could see that wasn't for me, you know? And then I would come back. And the process, I guess, for me, you know, just the rocks have gotten smaller. It's sort of more like gravel now. And I keep making mistakes. I guess I always will. I think to myself, I've been here for so long. Don't I know I'm supposed to bow now? Or you know, am I supposed to put my, you know, spoon and also kind of related to that, I've been thinking particularly in this session, but I know I do always, about the amazing thing that so many people remark on, that we're all here. I have very few friends who are even, I mean, outside of here, who are even a couple of friends who practice the Shambhala way. Other than that, nobody actually really knows much about me in a way. To come here in this group, and all groups are diverse, of course, so we're a very diverse group. We come from so many different backgrounds. It is that amazing thing about our being here. What a tremendously wonderful thing to have in common with all of you. And I'm very grateful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Melissa, I just wanted to say thank you for speaking so openly about your own practice and life. I think it's really... In a way, I think it's a teaching, because we tend to judge things by external appearance and to have a glimpse of what your inner life is like, and to see, you know, how it resembles mine and presumably everybody else's is just very instructive. So thank you for that. On the subject of hot water and rock salt, certainly, I think that a retreat like this is a bowl of hot water. And, you know, I can feel my own rough edges getting worn off. That's okay. But the prospect of dissolving in the bowl is, you know, quite frankly, it's terrifying. And yet I know that, you know, the feeling that I have when I come to the end, is such a relief, you know, to have lost all of those objections, those criticisms, that resistance to the process of the retreat. And I also think, taken as a whole, it is a profound teaching about self and other. You know, that, I mean, we can all say, well, there is no difference, and set out to realize that. But really, just to be involved in the process is a way of actualizing that and realizing that in an appropriate situation, that is, with everybody else. So thank you.
You know, it strikes me, the analogy about salt, which I kept grooving on it more and more as the talk went on, but I just got a little more groove here from you, Pierce, that one of the things that we feel happening is those edges melt away and we become dissolved. When the sashin is over, the salt dries off again, and we get to reshape it. And we almost always go back to the same shape because it's habit force. And there is that little chance that that we can leave some space in our lives so that the process of dissolving and reforming becomes more what our life is rather than maintaining the rock hard solidness of it. And that is possible. But I understand the fear in it too, because the fear is of an idea of it, not the actuality of it. We do have ideas about what that means, falling off a cliff, dissolving into a bowl of water. That doesn't sound good. But when these are just metaphors to describe something that you can't describe, but we're sort of edging around it. Thank you.
Christine and Laura?
Mine's really short.
The thing that has drawn me back here, it continues to miss the love. Just a
And I think this is the heart of our practice. One teacher said to the essence of Buddhism is to love everything and not to struggle. So we practice loving what is unacceptable. We practice loving what we love, loving what we hate. Actually, at the end of one retreat, Melissa and I led somewhere else, someone who was new to the practice came up and said that she was a kind of energy healer. What's a cranial sacral?
Oh.
So she works with these healing energies along the spine. And she said, what we've done is we've created a room full of this healing energy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we call this healing energy love. Sometimes we call it the Dharma. Sometimes we call it, hey, you. but there is something, this field, this boundless field of benefaction we sing about. And we go, where is it? Where is it? I'm bored. You know, my knees, where is it? Where is it? It's here. It's here. Right? Nowhere else.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Laura. Doug, after Maddie.
Okay.
Just what really touched me was that you said yes when you wanted to say no. And then to see what happened. And to jump into that, even though I still resisted, mm-hmm. even after I said yes, mm-hmm. you know, you said, I don't think I complained too much, right? So there was still that resistance, mm-hmm. and yet you said yes, and I heard also trust, mm-hmm. and entrusting, mm-hmm. in not only your teacher but in the Dharma, that you're being pulled a lot. There's an opportunity that's there, inviting, and sometimes I I get stuck in thinking that invitations should look a certain way and that I should want to say yes to them. And a lot of times in my life, the invitations have not looked the way that I thought they would. Yeah. And I really would have preferred to ask someone else. Incredible happens anyway, which I think again points to this teaching of not my life, right? Not mine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's so interesting, Laura. Going back to the koan that we've been working with, which is called Jufeng's disagreement. Right. So he's actually saying yes. Whenever this is a teaching. That I don't know where this came from. Maybe I made it up. But whenever you say, it's possible. Whenever you say no to something, you're saying yes to something else. Right. So what Jufeng was doing, he wasn't just being disagreeable and being a jerk or anything like that. He was saying yes to what he understood the Dharma of his teacher was. He was saying a big, enormous yes to it. And when you say that kind of yes, then the details sometimes don't matter. You'll bow, I'll bow, even though it doesn't... and everybody here really does that because you're still here. The test would be if you would leave now, like run screaming out the door. But there's some way that we're all doing this. We're all bowing to something much bigger than us. Stupid rules, stupid bowing. It doesn't make any difference. We bow. And we might hold in our hearts the resistance, and the resistance is never a problem. The saying no... in our hearts is not a problem. As long as we're in touch with the big, big yes that we're saying. Thank you for that.
And I think it goes back to what Ray was saying, that so to say, please don't struggle, doesn't mean don't struggle.
Right.
So please don't make up a difference between you and me is not another rule to follow. It's much more an invitation. What would it be? So of course these things, the struggle arises again and again, the comparing, the resentment. This is the water. This is the dissolving water of the Dharma. Everything that arises is this dissolving water.
Well, just going back to the other manifestation of Laura for a moment. We get two Lauras. It's like a double treat. I loved what you said about how you felt at the Vipassana retreat. Vipassana's great, terrific. Everyone should taste it at least once.
It's not.
You must be saying yes to something big. I often think of Zen as being like a hard candy with a really gooey center. Right? Because all this love we're talking about, it comes in the form of don't move, sit still. When the bell rings, bow. This incredible formal structure for me allows this juicy thing to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that appeals to me about Zen. And some teachings are gooey at the outside and gooey at the inside, and if that appeals to you, then go for the goo. And some teachings I found are also gooey at the outside and really hard at the inside, and those ones don't appeal to me at all. And they are really teaching right and wrong. So the rules is a word that of course comes to mind. But I like to think of them as guidelines. And if you don't do them, and if you screw up, like when I drank from the Buddha bowl the other day, Oh my God! Did I take this off? If you saw it. It was like this little moment of... it's like the Homer Simpson school of Zen.
Something about that discipline, that difficulty, that challenge is really, I think, helping to prepare us for opening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's how I see it. Yeah. So that's why falling on your tushy in public is really important for all of us. But don't do it just because, you know. Let it be an accident. Anyway, Mary.
Thank you so much for just the raw energy and authenticity of that talk. So what strikes me today about the koan is that Zhu Feng said, he didn't say, no, don't put this teacher in this role. He said, wait. And so I think that was maybe pointing to the just hold on, like they're already like, you know, probably buried the old teacher, or they already did, and they're just kind of going about the relative, you know, the daily lives and doing things. And the teacher was probably ready to like, he was like, okay, like I've been, you know, preparing for this, like it's sad, but I'm ready to step into this role. I've been preparing for years and years and years, and I understand everything. And so this really connects to me. I in Doksan the other day when I said, Melissa, I get it. You know, I just I'm really good at the game of pretending to myself that I've gotten rid of the I part of it, and then so I can just say, hey, get it. And then I can still be like, I get it, but I'm not saying the I. It's like delusion within delusion. And like I'm kind of related to that. I do feel like the Roxu is really cool and special. And I'm trying to just notice that and like point to it instead of pretending that it's not happening.
That's so great, Maddie. You know, and you're pointing to something that we all do. Every one of us, I think there are no exceptions in this room. We continually say, oh, I get it. I know what Zen's about. I figured it out. I get myself. I mean, think of the structure of those sentences. Yeah. And or they're just the same as I am a screw up. And we're so sure, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think you mentioned this—the how many ways we can fool ourselves, you know. And so it's not a matter of getting to the point where we don't fool ourselves. It's just appreciating the next one, and that so even our attachments are so important, you know, so precious to be aware, because of course we're attached, of course we get deluded. But when we get to see it instead of, and we all try to pretend and that doesn't work so well, so then we notice, oh yeah, I am a little attached. I am the one wearing the rock suit, sitting up front, whatever. And then that's what we work with. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. So Doug.
10 days ago I was in Ohio for a memorial get-together weekend for one of my high school buddies who passed away. A bunch of folks, some of them have not seen each other in decades, got together. My favorite story about this friend of mine, when he was in college, he was a geology major, and he was a TA for the freshman geology course, and this tiny freshman girl comes up to him asking him for help identifying the sample. Now, Gordon was a humongous, you know, scary kind of guy in terms of size. And he grabs the rock from her tray, puts it in his mouth, crushes it in his teeth. Halite! Something else that can happen to your salt.
And also a great lesson in taste this Dharma for yourself. Thank you, Doug. So, we'll... did you need to do your hand?
Who?
Carol. Oh, Carol, sorry, Carol. Yes.
It was just after the koan.
No, please.
I like all these stories.
Yeah.
I was thinking, as you were talking about invitations and so on, and about the way that Xu Feng kind of caressed the shoulder, exhibiting a love for him. And it seemed to me that he had offered Hedmuck an invitation to it was kind of honoring him as a human being. Here is an invitation to have an authentic relationship. Would you like it? And I had this experience, I don't think this is absurd, but before I came, I confronted my father, who's 93 years old, and we don't confront people who are aged and fragile. But I did, because I wanted that. I wanted not the relationship we had, but an authentic one. I wanted it for myself, but I also wanted it for my father. And of course, for me, this was a big risk, because unlike most people under the age of 60, you've confronted your fathers, I'm sure. But that wasn't the kind of relationship I had with my father. But when I heard this koan, I couldn't help thinking about it. And that this Shirvan took this risk. And this was a man he loved. But he knew there was something inauthentic. And the man had been living with them for years. He'd been the head of this whole sangha. He knew, and I think that maybe that Ted Abbott knew too, that he had these limitations and he couldn't get past them. And I think my father knew too. And this was just before I came here, so I'm hoping that when I go back, I'll find out he can open up in that way, and not that he's in the hospital because I gave him a heart attack.
but lovely, Carol, to point to this kind of the risk and this love for the authentic relationship. And to appreciate that aspect of the story in our lives, that sometimes we so want that authentic relationship with ourselves and with other people in our lives.
Yeah. And I'm touched that you brought that point up again about the love that he felt and the inability of the head monk to come forward as himself, because I was mentioned it on the first talk on the first day in Wansong's commentary. Wansong, collector of this Book of Serenity, he points to that same thing. He says, if only the head monk had just been able to say, I don't get it, or you know this better than me, teach me, then everything would have gone in a different way. And I love that. And that humility, you know, that Rumi calls it that broken, open lowliness, it is really part of this path. Not in some kind of, you know, look how broken, open, and low I am, but just this real capacity to say, I don't get what this is about. This doesn't make sense to me. What a brave thing to do. And then to make the connection to another human being through not pretending that we're better or know more or something, you know, that's just like the whole thing, isn't it? So I really am grateful to you for pointing that out. Thank you. And grateful to everyone. Thank you all.